And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full-service facilities from the foaling barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is moving like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. I'm laughing. For those of you that know where I set up, at Belmont, right on the apron, basically, if you're facing the track, it's to the right of the chute that comes from the paddock to the track. And I get the sometimes two breaks, or in this case, one break. So I frequently, it is morning and coffee's been involved, so I got to go to the bathroom here, all the way, which is, it's not too far, but for those of you that know, the Belmont Cafe is there, and then there's another, sort of ante-room, and there's a nice room that they set up for Belmont Day that's always a pretty, actually, cool place to spend the Belmont Day. So there's the bathroom back there, and I there's no heat in the building, which is, throughout the building, for the most part. And, upstairs, that's been one of the issues over the years when they've, whenever the discussion of, Breeders' Cups and so forth. And of course, there's been some, there's some Breeders' Cups here that it literally would take, if you came here on Saturday for Breeders' Cup, it would take till Monday or Tuesday to to thaw out. There was the one that was just, it was just unbelievable how cold it was here. But except in this bathroom, it could be 100 degrees outside, and that bathroom, the heat is blasting in that bathroom. It makes me laugh every time. It doesn't matter, and it's nice if it's a cold morning, it's great. And then there's other days you go in, it's like, oh my god, it's like a sauna. And I don't think I've seen any jocks in there actually trying to make weight, but it's an option, believe me. And it's funny because you you know, you go months without being here, and then when you walk in there, I hear the whir of the, it's like the thing is, and it's one of those big old clunky ones that, you know, that's probably been here since the, you know, since the 60s when it was, when the building was built. And so it's like this, you know, old hulking heater that's hanging in the corner. And I don't think there's a thermostat involved. I think it's either on or off. And it always seems to be on. this might be a you have to be there kind of thing. Let me, okay, Mig is, I just got the high sign from Mig. I just was about to ask him if he, I was going to see if he was ready. So let's get Richie in here. We'll talk to John White in a little bit and probably get one more visit in this morning after we spent the first half of the show dealing with what went on at Churchill. And Rich, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Sorry, I was a little hung up.
No, you're fine. I've got plenty Mondays. I got plenty to keep us busy, and then of course you folded in this this suspension of racing until relocation of the racing from Churchill to Ellis. So we spent a good portion of the morning. I don't know if you were. Sounds like you were in the car, so maybe you heard a little bit of Dale and Kenny and Mark Cass.
No, actually, I didn't get to hear. I had a run Carmella to get her car serviced, and then I dropped her off, and then I said, well, I got time, I'll run to the feed store, and then there's no service over there, and I got hung up in there, so I really didn't get to listen.
All right, well, you were sitting at having a front row during the weekend, and the racing integrating between Churchill and Belmont over the weekend. Plus, we threw in a little Monmouth yesterday in the cross country. But more to the point, too, Rich, it's Belmont week.
It's Belmont week. I'm so excited that you're in town. I haven't gotten to see you in person in I can't remember the last time, last summer maybe. So I'm looking forward to seeing you. I won't be back down till Thursday morning. And then I'm going to go into the city to do one of the morning shows on behalf of NYRA. And then I'm back on air 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon. And then Friday I'll be out in the morning. I'll come and see you. I have to say, and you probably heard this already, Tappet Trice has looked unbelievable. How good that horse is doing and training. Watching him, I have a hard time seeing past him.
Well, even without that kind of encouragement, he was everybody's Belmont horse going back to February.
Yeah, no, I know everybody's saying that. Like, I kind of, hedge about that. I don't know. It's a little early for all that stuff. But you watch his works, and anybody who has an opportunity to watch his last two works, watch him after he hits the wire, and obviously they're looking for big gallop outs, and that's one of Todd Pletcher's MOs. You know, he puts so much foundation in his horses with those big gallop outs. But his head drops about 6 inches, and his stride lengthens, and it's really visible. You know, sometimes we talk about this stuff, and it's not as apparent or it's not as obvious, and this is so obvious, and it's just a horse that keeps getting ground, and you know, so he's going 5 furlongs in a minute, out in 12, 7, 8, 25, pulling up a mile in 38, and not taking a long breath. I mean, it is the epitome of what we talk about when a horse has true stamina and has that efficiency of stride that allows him to cover so much ground so well. It's been fun for me to watch him train.
Give us, Rich. I know we do this, on a regular basis, and I think we might catch up with Gary Stevens this week too, who I understand is going to be around. And the two of you have talked about this race in particular. And give us that primer that we always discuss, which is just what a different animal it is. And you know, one complete circuit around this 12 furlong oval.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely different. I mean, first of all, we don't run many mile and a half races, particularly on the dirt, in North America anymore. I mean, you know, you probably, you know, a baker's dozen over the year, you know, for horses higher, you know, horses at a stakes level or a higher level, if you will. And again, being familiar with Belmont for a rider is so important because just, you know, everybody, we're all creatures of habit. And you get into a far turn at a mile racetrack, and what are you doing? You're starting to lean forward, giving your horse subtle cues to start going forward, getting into the race more. And it's subtle. It's not like they're going all in or asking the horse to do it, but your body posture, you're dropping into the horse a little bit instead of being in more of a rating pose. You're shortening up your hold a little bit instead of having that rating hold back towards their withers. And horses pick up on these cues, and they start marching. You do that at Belmont, you still got 5 furlongs to go, not 3 furlongs or 3.5 furlongs, depending on the racetrack. So, you know, it's considerably, and if you want to put it in this context, you're moving anywhere from 25 seconds to 18 seconds too soon. And, you know, for people, like, if they're not kind of grasping it in their mind as far as distance, think about making a move 25 seconds too early. That's very premature, isn't it? So I think from that, having horses switched off, and that goes part and parcel with not just the rider, but obviously the training. And that's one thing I think people need to start looking at more. Like, I love when people say, well, why didn't he send that horse? Well, maybe the horse wasn't sent to, you know, wasn't trained to have speed. You know, there's so much that goes on that the public doesn't see. And obviously the most visible part of it is the race itself and what the rider's doing. But if a horse's speed has been dulled in the morning and now he's not showing speed, it's not always just necessarily because the rider didn't want him to have speed. He just wasn't trained in a fashion. Or likewise, if a horse is too keen, maybe he's been trained to be sharper and more in the bridle and less off the bridle and switched off. And to get a mile and a half, you can't pull. You need a horse to be switched off. You need them to be efficient and attentive to the rider's cues, not a horse that runs through the bridle. I mean, and that's true in turf racing. That's true in any longer distance race. But it's something I've been thinking about so much because one thing I do on my days off and while I'm doing barn work or I'm out off hiking in the mountains is thinking how to present things to the public and saying it in a way that makes sense bring it from a different perspective. And it's so much more of a team effort than just, well, why did the rider do this or not do that? It goes part and parcel with how the horse has been handled in the morning and how he's come up to races. And again, I'll say it as a former rider, jockeys probably get too much credit for the win and too much criticism for the losses.
Hey, the other part of this, I'm just thinking about who's riding whom. You know, we've had plenty of occasion, particularly interestingly with Triple Crown tries, Rich, where guys have come in famously that aren't regulars here. And no matter how many times you discuss it with them, no matter how you try to show them, until they go around these turns at least once, it seems tough for unfamiliar jocks to understand the sweep of the turn, because it's not like a turn anywhere else. And I mean, I've heard it described. I can't remember if it's you or maybe Gary that described it years ago. I thought in great terms, you're going around a turn that's so gradual, you don't know you're on a turn.
Yeah, I mean, it could definitely fool you. And, you know, and to that end, I've heard people say this, that, well, it's not a big deal to be wide at Belmont because the turn is so wide and sweeping and gentle. But in essence, that's completely the opposite. You're spending considerably more time on a turn. So if you're wide the entire turn, you're wide for a quarter of a mile as opposed to 3/16 of a mile, or actually even more at Belmont, like 5/16 of a mile, you're wide. So, you know, years ago when it was the Belmont balcony move at Belmont that won, where you were better off being 5 or 6 wide just because the track was just so tiring towards the inside, hasn't been that way in years. So, you know, I don't understand if you're a rider that has won the Derby, won the Preakness, and you're coming in to Belmont Park with a legitimate chance to win the Triple Crown, or even a rider with just a legitimate Belmont-type horse, why wouldn't you come here a week early and just ride 3 or 4 days straight at Belmont? I mean, if you're in that position, you're probably in demand enough for your agent to make some phone calls and make some moves and get you on, you know, several horses and some live horses that are going to put you in the race. And it's really always been a little bit baffling to me how guys will come in like the day before or the morning of and not having that experience, that steady experience at Belmont. And now, you know, listen, I know there are people who say, well, I never won at Belmont, right? So what do I know? Well, I did win over 1,300 races at Belmont Park, and I do understand it. And, and honestly, I did win 1.5 miles races at Belmont, several, as a matter of fact. And, you know, Wheel Away, I couldn't give him a better trip. He just blew up underneath me at the 8th pole. And then unfortunately never ran again. He was vanned off and had surgery, and we tried to bring him back a few times, and that was a horse that had so much ability. He just, you know, it was just too much too soon trying to fit everything in a short period of time. But I would, if I was in that position and I was riding at another racetrack, I think I would do my level best to be here from the weekend before and stay in the place, be comfortable, you know. And obviously from the racetrack standpoint, because it's so unique, the only 1.5 miles dirt course in North America, but also just routine. There's something that to be said about being comfortable in a space, being comfortable in a jockey's room, being comfortable in the surroundings, knowing what time you leave for the paddock. It's a little different at every racetrack. Belmont, it's really different. You're down in the basement. You got to come up 2 flights of stairs and out to the paddock, and just to have that comfortability in a place, I think, really means a great deal.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I know that Stewie Elliott took a fair amount of criticism. I think other things ended up being at play is when it came to Smarties.
Smarty Jones never ran again, right? I mean, he and what a horse. I mean, what he did and what a great job John Service did. But, you know, it all fell squarely on Stewie. Now, I think Stuart Elliott's a terrific rider. I will say this, though, and I think because of Belmont's reputation for years of the inside not being good, he took some pressure from Eddington, and Rockhart 10 fell away from his inside early, you know, by the time they got to the backstretch. And when Eddington fell away, it was still probably 3/4 out, right? And Stewie had an opportunity to drop to the fence, and I think that would have given him a long breather, because Rockhart 10, as soon as Eddington fell away, came back up his inside. Up inside, it kept Smarty Jones on the bridle. He felt that horse's presence, and he was a very competitive horse. That's one of the things that made him so great. And it took away and negated that opportunity to get that breather, because he stayed out off the rail. And I think that if Stewie would have been more in tune with Belmont, particularly that week with it was a gold rail. I mean, the rail was phenomenal. I won the last race that day for Barry Schwartz on a horse named Bogota Bill, wire to wire on the rail. I think that was the only real mistake that Stewie made, was that if he had dropped to the fence, it would have stopped Rockhart 10 from re-engaging to the inside when Eddington fell away, and he might have gotten a real good breather from about the 5/8 pole at least to inside, or about the 3/8 pole. This is obviously with the benefit of hindsight, being able to watch the race probably 100 times now and looking and picking it apart, and things like that. I've seen riders make that mistake too, just assuming, oh, Belmont, you don't want to be on the rail. Nothing further from the truth now.
Well, and those, you know, those kinds of I don't want to call them old wives' tales, but they pervade. it sometimes it's just tough to get, you know, that mantra out of, you know, out of one's head and out of circulation in essence.
Yeah. I mean, we can go back to the 70s. I mean, think about all the horses that made that huge balcony move, and the most notable would be Forgo catching Honest Pleasure, like, right on the post in the Marlboro Cup. I mean, as good a race, I mean, that's top five races in my lifetime that I've ever seen. I mean, they just, you know, you can put a Fern in Aladar's Belmont. You could put Seattle Slough and Exceller when Exceller defeated him in the Jockey Cup Gold Cup. I mean, you know, I'm leaving some out now because I don't have things in front of me. But those are, that race stands up in there in that pantheon.
When it comes to Belmonts, because it's always been fun to, even though we don't have a Triple Crown try, the ones, what was the first one you saw, actually? Because you love going back and remembering, you know, your occasions coming to the track as a young fan.
Well, I mean, I saw Belmonts on TV. I saw Secretariat. I can remember distinctly watching Secretariat on a black and white TV in our apartment in Brooklyn as a, you know, an 8-year-old, right? Remember both Forbes distinctly because I was a huge Honest Pleasure fan and huge fight with one of my best friends growing up. He loved Bull Forbes and Angel Cordero. I loved Honest Pleasure and Braulio Baeza. So then we got beat in the Derby. Honest Pleasure was off the trail after the Preakness. And then what Angel did and Laz Barrera did to get Bull Forbes to go on half. And I remember watching that at home on TV as well, actually with that same aforementioned friend. But my first Belmont live was 1977, Seattle Slough. I was a Mad Dog racing fan by then. I was involved with, you know, working with ponies and stuff. And I wanted to go so badly, and I kept, you know, kind of hinting about it and dropping, you know, hints to my father. And on the morning of the Belmont, I got back from working at the pony ride and, you know, mucking stalls, and he said, you know, get ready. And I was like, well, what are we doing? And he says, well, we're going to Belmont. And so like that, I didn't even know until right then. And we went to Belmont. And interestingly enough, I can remember exactly where we sat. And it's about 30 yards from where our set is now for America's Day at the races on the third floor. And it was the single greatest day I ever had in my entire life with my father. He was betting. He was having a good day. I remember some of the horses on the undercard. It was just, and the atmosphere was so electric. And then when Seattle Slough, you know, was coming to, he went past us about the 16th pole, and he's going to win, and I was in awe of it. And then I was like, oh, no, crew game's falling off. And John was standing up celebrating early, but I thought he had lost his balance. But it was just a phenomenal day. And I remember leaving the races that day and listening to all of these people talk about it. And I was so swept up in the atmosphere. So it was already, the fuse had already been lit for me to be on the racetrack and be a fan. Just got a whole, you know, bunch of logs thrown on it and it fanned the flame. I mean, that was a phenomenal day of racing.
Well, what was your first, I don't have the press, the media guide. What was your first Belmont mount?
My first Belmont mount, that was a saga, was Eternal Prince. I got to give you the quick story. Walter Guerra was named on him in February, I believe, or late January. He was still a maiden for Butch Lanzini. And Walter didn't come. Something happened. He couldn't make it, or he decided not to come north. I pick up the mount. He won very easily. He came back. He won an allowance race very easily in a short turnaround. And then we ran in the Bayshore. And Pancho Villa, trained by Wayne, outran us to the lead, and Eternal Prince didn't run that well. So we came back in the Gotham, and I let Eternal Prince roll, and he went wire to wire, and that was a big deal for me to win the Gotham. I, you know, grew up, this was the races I grew up watching. And then Steinbrenner bought back into the horse from Brian Hurst because he had sold him originally as a yearling. And we won the Wood Memorial and, you know, beat Proud Truth, beat a good group, Roman Rule. And, you know, but we got to really walk the dog on the lead. And I went down to Churchill Downs the Monday before the Derby to work. Me and Jacinto traveled together. He went to work for Roman Rule. And my horse worked awful. I mean, he just was like a just dull. I mean, he was off the bridle. He, you know, he had run a lot in a very short period of time. And Derby Day, he got left at the gate. He got distracted from the infield crowd when they said it is now post time. He had never seen an infield crowd. He got left. I got so much criticism. I mean, it was outlandish the amount of criticism I got. Spend a Buck ran an amazing race, went 45, you know, kept running. And everybody said that, you know, it was my fault that Eternal Prince got beat. He, you know, he got left at the gate. And that was one thing I was noted for being a good gate rider. Anyway, they took me off. I mean, the headlines were Steinbrenner sacks jockey, right? Because he had, I think, just got done firing Billy Martin or something. Yeah. So Chris McCarron picks him up for the Preakness, and he got to go easy on the lead, and he still was third, beating 5.5 lengths to Tank's Prospect, who caught Chief's Crown right on the wire. And now he was supposed to get a break, and all of a sudden, my agent, Maurice Farias, at the time, comes to me and says, hey, they're going to run the horse into Belmont. I think we got the mount back. And there was a part of me that wasn't thrilled about that because I'm like, he can't get a mile and a half in a Sally horse van. I mean, so I picked the mount back up, and, you know, he was basically eased. I mean, he showed speed and was eased. Then he got his vacation, and he came back. He never won another race after the Wood Memorial. We talk about jockeys getting too much blame, too much credit. I definitely took way more heat than I ever deserved for all of that. You know, I was young, and everybody wanted to point out. And even disappointingly, Joe Hirsch wrote something in one of his books. I never saw Joe Hirsch that day. He never came and spoke to me. He was never in the jockey's room. That I was so nervous in the jockey's room that I looked, you know, pale and tight as a string. I never saw Joe Hirsch that day. And ironically, I had ridden 4 or 5 races on the undercard for Mark Cassie. Me and Mark were friends. He had come to New York for the winter. And, you know, he was a young trainer still. I was a young rider still. And I went out to ride one of his horses on the undercard. I even said to him, Mark, I don't understand why I'm not more nervous. I just didn't feel very nervous about the whole thing. Things didn't work out. And I remember going to see Joe Hirsch after that, after he wrote that, and I said, that's just not true, and I don't understand how you could write this. You never even saw me Derby Day or spoke to me. And he said, oh, well, somebody told me that. And I said, well, that's just completely incorrect. Oh, I'll make it up to you. Well, I'm still waiting, but I guess it's never going to happen.
Well, it's a little late now. Yeah.
Yeah, no, well, that's my point.
Wow. I'm surprised, actually, you don't hear too many disappointing stories.
Well, no, but that's the truth of it.
I believe it. Yeah.
Angel told him the story. Angel made himself the star of that show, and you know, I had talked to Angel about that afterwards, and me and Angel are friends, and I have nothing but respect for Angel. But that was it's satellite raising it. A lot of bullshit.
Thank you. Good job. There's nothing. How about your best? What was the best scenario at Belmont?
Well, Wheel Away. I mean, Wheel Away was a legitimate horse. I mean, he was a really good horse. I mean, he didn't stay sound, and he didn't break his maiden until the end of January. So again, another horse trying to fit a lot in a short period of time, but. After the Derby, you know, he swooped up, took the lead in the Derby about the 3/16 pole. Fousse IT Pegasus followed me, blew by me, and he got to lugging in that day. And to be fair, I didn't correct him very much because I felt like I didn't want to thwart any of his forward momentum, and I did sideswipe Captain Steve, and I got a 5-day suspension for it, and it was deserved. And, you know, it was still a little bit of that mentality that, yeah, anything goes in the Derby. They've kind of, you're righted that ship, you know, more recently, right? But John, you know, you got to say, John Kimmel and I are really good friends. I love John Kimmel. He's like a brother to me. And I left Louisville after the race, and then I get home, and I'm reading, I think, in the racing forum on Monday. John criticized me. He thought I hit the front too soon. And I didn't like the way he worded it, and I didn't like the way he said it. Now, to be fair, he was probably emotional right after the race, and he got back to New York Wednesday, and I went in his office fully prepared to never ride for him again. I went off and basically said, if I ride a race that you think, you know, is a bad ride, or you have criticism or a question about a ride, as much as we've worked together, as much as we've done together, as much time as I spend in this barn, you owe it to me to have that conversation here behind closed doors in the office. And I really went off about, like, I'm cleaning it up, but this was basically the message. And to his credit, and John's a very thoughtful, you know, person, he said, you're right. You're 100% right. I should have talked to you. So going into the Belmont, John was very much just don't hit the front too soon. Don't hit the front too soon. And if you watch that race on YouTube, I'm cruising coming to the 5/16th pole. It looks like I cannot lose this Belmont. And I got to be honest with you, Steve, I wanted to rip the race open right there. I just wanted to, like, I was still in the bridle and said, let me just, you know, everybody struggles with this last 3/16ths. Let me just put this thing to bed right now. And I didn't because of, you know, John saying don't hit the front too soon. And listen, my horse flattened out and he never ran again. He had surgery like the next week, you know, if he had a bunch of chips and stuff. So maybe it wouldn't have mattered. But I always felt like, and he finished fourth that day and he ran a great race. He got assistance getting home. He couldn't get home on his own. I think a van picked him up outside the paddock and brought him back to the barn. But he was a good horse. If we had not thought about the Derby and all that and concentrated on the second half of the year, he's a horse that could have run the table the second half.
How about that? And I think didn't Magic Weisner finish fourth too?
Yeah, he finished fourth. He actually was next to War Emblem. War Emblem stumbled really bad into me.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you right now, my little horse, he wasn't very big. He took full force of War Emblem hitting him, but I actually think it helped War Emblem back on his feet. Like, it kind of stopped War Emblem from continuing to stumble in, and it kind of knocked him back, straightened him up a little bit, and he was able to find his feet. And he tried. I mean, he didn't want the mile and a half. He was that was as game a horse as I ever rode. Steve, he did not move good. He hit the ground ugly. I mean, but you want to talk about desire? Listen, he wouldn't have never been able to run in any of those races if it was right now, considering the climate and the scrutiny. But the day he won the Ohio Derby, he warmed up. I mean, just, he was like a spider crab. He just didn't have good action. He wasn't mechanically sound, if you will. I mean, you know, we talk about horses with these strides and how impeccable they move. He was the complete opposite of that. But his heart, he just willed himself. He just refused to lose. He put his head down and went and caught him and came back like he was drunk. He was so exhausted from the effort that he was, when he finished second in the Preakness, I had to walk him back. He put so much into his races, there was nothing left. And Nancy Alberts did an amazing job of that race because he was not a good mover. And now I'll give you another story real quick. I was riding him after he won the Ohio Derby. She's pointing for the Haskell. And the way he came back after the Ohio Derby, I was like, gosh, I just don't know. One day it's, you know, he just doesn't feel good. And my agent and I decided I'll stay in Saratoga that day. They ran the Jim Dandy and the Haskell on the same day. And I was going to ride Iron Deputy for Jimmy Jerkins. And I had other mounts that day. So Mike Luzzi picks up the mount. And I talked to Mike about it. I said, Mike, look, he's not a good mover. You're not going to be thrilled with the way he warms up. But this is him, man, and he'll try. He finished second to War Emblem again. He was beaten three or four lengths, but gave his typical, you know, incredible reach down and give more than I have to give effort. And that was the last race. He never ran again. I'm riding Iron Deputy, and I'm trying to follow Medaglia Doro at the top of the stretch in the Jim Dandy, and Jerry Bailey tapped Medaglia Doro on the shoulder, and he cut. I mean, he cut for home. And I tried to follow him, but his acceleration was so much better than Iron Deputy's that he got through the gap, and by the time I got there, the gap was closing, and I got dropped at the eighth pole. I got squeezed and went down. And I'm in the hospital that night. I got knocked out, and I go, I didn't go to the Haskell because I was worried because that horse doesn't feel good. And I got dropped in the Jim Dandy on a horse that is as sound as a bell of brass. I said, you can't run from your destiny. Whatever's meant to be is going to be.
Right?
I
mean, right?
I mean, I'm trying to maneuver, and I maneuvered myself right into that one. And how about Medaglia Doro? After he ran in the Preakness, I was working a lot of horses for Bobby Frankel. And he, you know, I worked him one morning at Belmont, and he worked sensational after the Preakness. I mean, as good as a horse can work. And Bobby, I said, Bobby, what are you doing with this horse? And I had Magic Wiser in the Belmont, and he goes, I'm going to run him on the grass. He trains too good, and then he didn't run at all in the Preakness. I think he's a grass horse. And I said, I think you're crazy if you don't run this horse in the Belmont. And he wound up running that horse in the Belmont on my say-so. He finished second to Sarava.
Yep.
And DeZormo rode him that day, and then Bailey got the mount, and then he wins the Jim Dandy, the Travers. I mean, he was ready to put him on the grass.
Hey, it's so funny how, you know, how many, there's so many stories like this, last weekend? Who was the horse, who was it last weekend that, the horse of Peter Ertens that has suddenly, you know, become a monster with the move to grass, Exalted, right? Exalted last week.
Yes.
It's a funny, it's one thing. It's one thing when they've got the pedigree and you go along and you go dirt for as long as you can. But when they don't have the pedigree and you're trying it out of desperation, or the flip side, when you think, well, this horse is destined for turf, and there were other things at work that dirtied the horse's record up.
Yeah, you know, sometimes horses are just working through things, and we're impatient to let them work through it. We're searching for answers when maybe there's not an answer. It just needs a little time to breathe, right?
Well, and you know, I brought this up last week, not so much regarding Shirzando's situation, but the unraced Irish Warcry filly we've got, and you know, these horses, they're growing, they're still growing until they're five, until they're horses and until they're mares. And there's periods, and you always describe this well, Rich, about the seventh and eighth grader versus the 11th and 12th grader, and you know, there's periods when their bodies they lose coordination because a part of their anatomy has grown at a slightly different rate. You know, the front end and the back end, you know, they come in and out of alignment as a horse is growing. And there's also, you know, there's also some strange things I think people don't realize. Horses, and I'm going to forget the percentage. If there's, I'm sure there's some of our equestrian experts that know this, but if I'm not mistaken, the length of a horse's leg at birth is a shockingly high percentage of what it ultimate the ultimate length of their leg. Their legs don't get all that much longer as they go from foal to yearling to 2 year old. I don't know if it's 75% or 65%, but
I don't think it could be 75, but it's disproportionate, obviously, to their body. So their body is going to do a lot more growing than those legs are.
Exactly, and at the same time, their legs are going to grow, and when you see them laying down with their legs out straight, it their legs are bothering them, and they need, you know, sometimes it's for 3 weeks. There's a period of time where they're basically communicating, you know, leave me alone, I'm growing. And it takes however long it takes to get them, you know, back into a fluid, you know, movement. And it's not all at the same time. It doesn't.
No, learning to manage their body, learning to you know, just what you're saying. Just because the front end really grew and developed didn't mean the hind end caught up or like, you know, likewise. And it's, you see the same thing with kids. You'll get a kid that, man, he looks like a world beater. Then like a year goes, like, what happened? And then they find it again.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've had so many conversations over the years, and I miss him so dearly because of, for so many reasons, but, you know, feed time at Alan Jerkins's and after the horses are fed, sitting on a bale of hay and listening and asking questions and talking. And he brought up so many instances of two-year-old fillies that were incredibly precocious that just weren't the same at three. And he said, what the mistake a lot of people make is they retire them because they're grade one winners or a champion at two, and they go, well, they just didn't go on at three, and, the, you know, we're not going to enhance their value. Maybe we'll diminish their value. And then if they gave them a chance, they're world beaters at four. Their body kind of reshaped during that three-year-old year, and they were learning to deal with all that and hormonally. And I mean, horses are not so different than people in that respect. And you know, like, you know, I say on the show is what you're just talking about. Kid that might be the best athlete starting 7th or 8th grade is not necessarily the best athlete by 11th or 12th grade. The kid that hadn't reached puberty starting, you know, 8th grade, all of a sudden he hits his stride, grows up. You know, there's a kid that always was a kid that was shaving early in school. His voice had already changed, right?
Yeah.
Horses are not dissimilar to people that way. And also mentally, some horses truly want to be the herd leader. They want to be the boss. They have that extra effort in them, that try. There's a Magic Wiser, you know, you get some little kid on Pee Wee football that has no business playing football because he's smaller than all the other kids, but guess what? He's got the biggest heart. There's that. That's the intangible. That's what makes our game so incredible. You could look at it from all the scientific, logical ways, confirmation, this and that, but then does that horse have the heart, the class, the intelligence? There's things lurking in there that you can't define by looking at them, that they'll define to you as they go on. I mean, this is one of the things that makes it so fascinating and so great. You don't know where another good horse is coming from because of those, you know, intangible qualities. I mean, I love the game so much because of all of that. To me, it's incredibly fascinating. I think, you know, if we get people to understand just what, like, look at a horse, look at, man, there's so much going on there. Not just, you know, it ticks the boxes, oh, he's correct, he's straight, the length of the pastern, this, that. There's, it goes so much deeper.
I got to ask you, we're going to spend time on Friday when we're handicapping ahead of Saturday. So we'll do some of that kind of stuff, obviously. But I want to ask you about one horse, because the undercard on Saturday will be outstanding, and the Friday and Thursday cards are already setting a stage for what we're going to get on Saturday. But the Jiper, we're going to watch as Casa Cree tries to retire the trophy with a third straight Jiper, and I'm going to offer up this week's horse that time forgot. There's always going to be a few of these, and I'm sure you know where I'm going, even though it wasn't the same race that it is now. But Basket Weave in 1986, wow. Right? This is a horse nobody brings up.
No, and a good horse, man. Wow, was he a good horse? Bobby Reinecker. Is my Stop the Music?
Now you're going to make me check. I'm going to have to check that portion of the equation. I just saw, I had the Jiper on a different thing and page, and I said, let me look at the Jiper and see if Rich, and sure enough, there you were. By Best Turn.
Best Turn, okay, yes. Man, he was a dark bay, like, really intense horse. What a great eye on him. He was such a good mover. My God, he felt like he floated over the ground. And he wound up being a terrific sire out in the Northwest, right? If I'm not mistaken, the Washington State, he was like a perennial leading sire out there. Green Tree Stable, you know, when it was still, you know, part of the heyday of that. I kind of sometimes forget Bobby Reinecker is just one of the best horsemen and one of the best people I've ever known. How integral Green Tree and Bobby Reinecker were, particularly, that was 86. You know, then I broke my neck in 88 and went through, you know, a long convalescence and rehab, and I actually started getting on Bobby's pony, Deacon, first back at Green Tree when I first could start getting on horses. And what an integral part of my recovery and supporting me coming back. You know, Bobby was one of the first guys that immediately didn't hesitate to use me when a lot of people were hesitant. You know, how could he possibly be the same after that, you know? And, you know, you don't always get the opportunity to articulate how grateful and how appreciative you are with that people that were able to step up. Mrs. Whitney, Green Tree, Bobby, obviously, Mr. Vanderbilt. These were people that really, you know, stepped up, came to the fore immediately, that, you know, to put me on horses right away and show confidence in me, even when maybe I wasn't sure myself if I was going to be able to do it, you know. So really good horse though, Steve. He had another horse, Parade Ground, was a terrific horse. I'm going to forget name. They named a horse Surgeon's Care for you know, after the doctor that actually put me back together. Was a real nice Cairo Colt, won three in a row. Ultimately, he got injured. But no, it was just a wonderful, wonderful time in that stable. And Carmella was Bobby's assistant for a while. I actually won a race for Carmella in the Green Tree Colors with a horse named Jimmy Symington in 89 after I got back from being injured.
I love it. And that's what's fun about just, you know, drawing a wild card and throwing it past you. Rich, go handle those chores. You got a couple of days at home before things get exciting here. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the Belmont Stakes Racing Festival. We'll talk together live on Friday. Should be a lot of fun here with the Jimmy Ventura and Hammer and Nick Tamaro, and we got all kinds of fun typically on Friday. It's always a little bit of mayhem here.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Shoot me a text about what time would be good for you for me to come around.
Sounds good. Rich Migliori, he came around at about age 14. As they say on the racetrack, when, you know, when did you come around?
Hey, Steve, I know we got to wrap up, but I was about 14 years old, 13 years old, track rat. Mr. Whiteley, Frank Whiteley, really liked me, and I'd go hang out with him when he'd be hosing Forgo and just talk to him. Barkley Tagg was one of the assistants. He'll deny this, but he used to want to run me off because he felt like I was getting in the way of getting done because Mr. Whiteley would be hanging out talking.
I love it. I loved it. That's great. Rich Migliori.
See you Friday.
Thanks, Meg. Mig 4450 joining us. John White is next, and we got to talk to John about what went on at Santa Anita over the weekend. I still should get Richard. I did not reach out to Richard Mandela, but window shopping in the Oaks and Go Rocket Ride in the Affirmed. But I guarantee you that the mention of Basket Weave and his career as a stallion in the Pacific Northwest, that's going to light John up. And John's got some Belmont and Triple Crown things that he's always, it's one of his favorite, the whole Triple Crown series. If you've been reading John, as you have for years and years, John White is going to join us here momentarily. I've also, we'll see, because it's holy cow, the day is absolutely rifled through today. It's 11:25 already. All right, we'll see. If there's time, I had one trainer guest that I was going to try to get to, but we may save it for tomorrow. John White joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you today?
Outstanding. Belmont and in our usual station here on the track apron, the swallows that have their nests right above my head, and they come swooping in, and there's the work in the infield is kind of fun. Just I can't wait to see a rendering of what how this is all gonna come about. It's gonna take several years, but I know there's people that are trepidatious and concerned about, you know, what Belmont is going to be a decade from now, but I'm sure there were people that were concerned in 1960 about what Belmont was going to look like when they last addressed the issues here. So they got a lot to work with. Let's put it that way.
Well, happy Belmont Week, and of course this is going to be really celebrated for the 50th anniversary of the Great Secretariat and his spectacular 31-length win. Also, Chick Anderson's iconic call, he's moving like a tremendous machine. That was a very big moment in my lifetime because in my high school newspaper in March that year, I'd written in my sports column, going out on a limb and living dangerously, I dare say, the 1973 will be a historic year as Secretariat will become the first Triple Crown winner since the Great Citation in 1948. And I wrote about Secretariat not only there in March, predicting that he'd win the Triple Crown, which, of course, there hadn't been a Triple Crown winner in 25 years. But after he got beat in the Wood Memorial, finishing third to Englewhite and Sham, I also wrote in my high school paper, I said, stick with Secretariat. You can always throw out one race for a horse. And I thought that the slow pace may have been the main reason that Secretariat did not win the Wood. Penny Chenery, known at that time as Penny Tweedy, felt that way at first. And, of course, then there's this Bill Knack wrote in his book, and it's been written elsewhere, that he had a big old abscess in his mouth. Whatever the reason, in the Wood Memorial, he came back 2 weeks later, broke the track record in the Kentucky Derby. As we now know, he's finally credited with breaking the record in the Preakness Stakes, having run the fastest Preakness Stakes, fastest Kentucky Derby, and then that 224 flat. As Chick Anderson said to the CBS viewers, a record that may stand forever. And boy, that's spot on, because it's hard to envision that record it'll ever be broken, as he absolutely obliterated Gallant Mann's track record that day. But I was sitting in my living room. My mom was taping that race for me. In those days, my mom would sit with a reel-to-reel tape recorder and sit in front of the TV and tape the Triple Crown races for me. And it was really great, because that 1973 Triple Crown, to have those reel-to-reel tapes.
Wow.
When I would make the 200, and this is going to be good for the Long Acres drinking game today. When I would make the 276-mile drive from my home to Long Acres, I would play those three Triple Crown reel-to-reel. Because back then on CBS, it was an hour telecast. It was nice and tight. You know, it wasn't hours and hours and hours. It was just a really good hour broadcast, you know, with a tremendous broadcast team. Jack Whitaker, Haywood Hale Bruin, Chick Anderson, and so forth. And you know, it was so great to watch Secretariat come down that stretch that day, pulling away, because so many people at that time thought that we might never see a Triple Crown winner again,
right,
much like we thought when we got to American Pharoah with a 37-year drought. And for Secretariat not only to win the Belmont Stakes, but to win it the way he did, I mean, it was so emotional for me. And I got my whole high school and many of the kids interested in horse racing because of what I wrote in my school newspaper. And even in my journalism class, my teacher was kind enough to let me, Mr. Juan Aylman, who was the head of the newspaper, he was the advisor for the school newspaper, but over in a very tiny corner on the chalkboard, he let me keep a future book on the Kentucky Derby odds. So it's kind of a sign that that would be what I would be doing in my life, would be involved in horse racing. And now, of course, as a morning line maker, involved in making odds. But so that was a huge, huge memory for me with Secretariat. My dad was at Long Acres that day. And when he came home, he was telling me that when Secretariat opened up like a 2.5 or 3 length lead, he was so thrilled. And little did he know at that time that, of course, it would go to 10 lengths, 15 lengths, 20 lengths, 25 lengths, and finally 31 lengths. But when you watch that Secretariat Belmont Stakes, I can appreciate my dad's feeling because, again, we thought there might never be another Triple Crown winner. Here was Secretariat actually opening up a 2.5, 3 length lead, and you're getting kind of excited at that point. So a lot of memories of that particular. And then I was very interested in Richard Migliori's comments on Medaglia d'Oro, because I liked Medaglia d'Oro in the Preakness that year, and he turned into a huge wise guy horse coming off his fourth in the Kentucky Derby. For some reason, people kind of went overboard on him, I thought. I mean, I liked him in the Preakness, but I didn't, you know, there were so many people on board that I thought, you know, this never works when the whole world is kind of glomming onto a horse like that. And he ran absolutely horribly that day. I mean, he just, it was a very poor performance. He finished eighth, got beat like about 17 lengths. And I remember Frankel saying right after that race, and Richard Migliori alluded to this, Frankel said, I'm going to send him home and run him on the grass at Hollywood Park. Well, when Medaglia d'Oro showed up in the Belmont Stakes, I thought, wow, that's interesting that Frankel is doing this about face from what he had said he was going to do. And so I bet 100 to win and 100 to place. And this shows you there's many different ways to handicap a race, but this was strictly handicapping Frankel. And I thought, boy, he's not going to send this horse to New York, where Frankel is from, and get embarrassed. This horse must be very live in this race. So I bet 100 to win, 100 to place. He went off a 10 to 1. And coming down the stretch, I thought he was going to win. I felt pretty good about my bet when War Emblem stumbled at the start. Of course, War Emblem was going for the Triple Crown. And lo and behold, here comes Saraba. You know, it is as a huge long shot in the race. In fact, the longest shot to ever win the Belmont Stakes at 70 to 1. Your guest earlier on the broadcast, Kenny McPeak. But at least I was smart enough on that occasion to back up my win bet. One reason I did that was respect for War Emblem in case he did win the Triple Crown. I didn't want Medaglia d'Oro to run a big race and finish second at a big, you know, nice 10 to 1 and not get some money back. So he paid $16 to place that day. So I have a belated thank you to Richard Migliori for saying to Bobby Frankel, you should run that horse in the Belmont, Bobby. Forget about running him on the grass in California.
Yeah, that's funny, actually. I love it. I love it. John, a couple of things. Let me slip in the performances. A big weekend for Mandela out there. Talk about window shopping, winning the Oaks. And then yesterday, Go Rocket Ride. Skinner ended up bypassing the race. Talk, though, about window shopping. She stepped forward.
She certainly did. I mean, this is a very talented filly. She really kind of showed that in her maiden victory. It was a race taken off the turf. It was her second career start. She was an odds-on favorite and won by a city block that day, literally, officially 16.5 lengths with Pratt aboard. And I thought she was very live in the Santa Anita Oaks, and she had a troubled trip that day. I thought she would get bet more in the Santa Anita Oaks than she did. She was 5-1 that day. And she did have the trouble. And one of the reasons I didn't make her a lower price than 5-1 on the morning line for the Summertime Oaks is because she didn't get bet more than she did in the Santa Anita Oaks. But she ended up going off here at 7-2 in the Summertime Oaks and really looked good. And here's Hector Berrios, a guy I keep talking about on your show a lot. Two riders I keep talking about a lot are Hector Berrios and Ramon Vasquez. And it was Vasquez who was aboard Go Rocket Ride yesterday for Mandela to win the Affirm Stakes. So those two riders, they're more and more becoming two of my favorites. I have no problem betting on those guys at any time. And window shopping, we talk about the Belmont Stakes being run this week. You talk about a pedigree that's got the Belmont Stakes influence. American Pharoah, of course, was a Belmont Stakes winner to end a 37-year Triple Crown drought. And that's window shopping's sire. And window shopping's out of a Tappet mare. And Tappet is a name we're going to hear quite frequently here in the next few days, as Tappet, of course, has sired four Belmont Stakes winners. And looks like he's got a good chance to maybe make that five this year, as he's got real contenders in this year's Belmont Stakes. The window shopping, interestingly, I would have thought this race was formerly the Hollywood Oaks. Now it's called the Summertime Oaks because it's at Santa Anita. And I would have thought that Richard Mandela would have won the Hollywood Oaks / Summertime Oaks, you know, three, four, five times maybe. This was only his second win in this race. He'd won it with Brooks Halo in 2005 with John Cord aboard. So this was Mandela's second win in the Summertime Oaks. And the Affirm Stakes, again, talking about the Triple Crown, that, of course, honors the 1970 Triple Crown winner, trained by Laz Barrera, ridden by Steve Coffin. And one of the great Triple Crowns of all time with that rivalry of Affirmed and Alidar. The Go Rocket Ride provided Richard Mandela with his first win in the Affirm Stakes, which was formerly the Silver Screen Handicap. And that's a race that, when it was run at Hollywood Park in 1986, was won by the brilliant filly trained by John Sadler, the California-bred filly Malaire. Malaire won all five of her career starts, and she won that Silver Screen Handicap, beating Southern Halo as the runner-up, but finishing third, 11 lengths behind Malaire, was the Preakness winner that year, and the eventual Eclipse Award-winning three-year-old male Snow Chief, trained by Mel Studi. And that was one of the most impressive races I've ever seen in person by a filly or mare, as Malaire ran a mile around one turn and 1:32 and change that day. In fact, I was driving out of Hollywood Park after the races that day. I called that chart for the racing form, that Silver Screen Handicap in 1986. And as I was driving, leaving the track, the guy that drove right up next to me as we got to the street to leave the Hollywood Park grounds was none other than John Sadler. He pulled up right to my left, and he rolled down his window, I rolled down my window, and I said, "Congratulations, John, that was just fantastic." And he said, "Yeah, that was a lot of fun." And then the light changed and we drove off. But that was very impressive. And for Go Rocket Ride, that was a big win because, of course, he had missed the Santa Anita Derby. He had come up with an elevated temperature and had to scratch. And they're talking about the Grade 1 Haskell at Monmouth Park as something that they're seriously thinking about for Go Rocket Ride, who is a very talented candy ride colt here for Mr. Mandela.
Well, first of all, window shopping out of delightful joy. You mentioned the Tappet thing, and that was, I want to say, the Chad Brown. That was a Chad Brown filly that won. I think she was a stakes horse. And when we look at Go Rocket Ride, which, you know, we love these kinds of horses, John, that, you know, made noise and you know, that there was interest and excitement about, you know, early in the, you know, the Triple Crown lead up. And of course, second to Practical Move in the San Felipe. And so it's nice to get, you know, this horse rolling again. Interestingly, you know, bred by Larry Best, by Oxo, and out of the Uncle Mo mare, Beyond Grace. We'll probably talk about this a little with Sid on Wednesday. $350,000 Phasic July Yearling Candy Ride Colt that Pin Oak, the new Pin Oak, campaign.
Well, another highlight over the weekend was Jose Valdivia getting his 2000th North American win.
Yeah.
That was really quite a milestone for Mr. Valdivia. He began his writing career right about the time I had switched over from working for the Racing Form to go into TV at Santa Anita. And I remember interviewing him when he was an apprentice and asking him to make sure that I was pronouncing the last part of his name right, because I always wanted to get people's names correct when I was on the air. And, I mean, he's had quite a career. I mean, he won the Breeders' Cup Mile aboard Val Royal for Julio Canani. He won a Belmont Stakes on Ruler on Ice.
That's right.
He was a dominant rider at Arlington Park as the leading rider there from 2015 to 2019. And he was even a leading rider. He won a riding title over at Fairplex Park in Pomona, that the former track there that I worked as a steward at a couple of times. So really congratulations to Jose Valdivia. He even won a race at Ascot for Wesley Ward in 2016, as Steve Anderson reported in the Racing Forum, and he had a couple of wins in his native Peru. So those are on top of the 2000 North American wins. He's a huge Yankees fan, and so his family was on their way to Dodger Stadium to watch the Yankees play the Dodgers as the Yankees beat the Dodgers Saturday 6-3. And Valdivia skedaddled out of Santa Anita and was able to get there for most of the game. So he's a huge Yankees fan. But so that was kind of neat over the weekend. It's always nice when we see these riders and trainers get these milestones.
Well, and it had been, you know, we get these Equibase sends out trainer and jockey milestone alerts. And, you know, that sometimes, they inch, and you know, they tell you the so-and-so has got, you know, two mounts today, or, you know, so-and-so has got four horses entered today, and you know, you watch it, and you know, it's one of those things that I don't know why it takes, in some cases, it guys approach, and this is true in baseball and the like as well, they approach those milestones, John, and they freeze up for some reason, and it takes you know, an excessive period of time to get that breakthrough win.
It's amazing how often that happens.
It's crazy.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I remember it especially back in the day with Bill Shoemaker and Lafitte Pinkai Jr., and we would be on alert for that here in Southern California, like, again, when I was working as a writer for the Racing Form, and you'd have to be on alert. And in fact, Shoemaker was so big that the whole Los Angeles media was, you know, on top of that, because it was such a huge story in the Los Angeles area for Shoemaker, any of these milestones of his. And then I remember there was one time that we were on alert for a milestone of one of the biggies for Pinkai, like a 5,000 or 6,000 or whatever. And they celebrated it, and then they found out they recounted, and they found out he was one short. So they had to do it again, because there had been a mix-up, and they had miscalculated. So I remember that with Pinkai, that was kind of an embarrassment for our game, which I've alluded to on a number of occasions, how our sport really takes a back seat to the major sports in terms of statistics and records and so forth. That a lot of times somebody sets a record in horse racing and we don't even know about it for a week. Whereas if you're watching the Olympics or you're watching baseball, basketball, football, especially with the Elias Sports Bureau, these people know that this is a record as it's happening. And like I say, racing too often, we're really do a bad job in terms of being on top of these records. Thank goodness for Equibase in terms of these milestones. That's one thing they do. But in a lot of records, we really don't do a good job in horse racing, in my opinion.
Well, and one of the things about it that makes it, I don't know, it's easy, it's easy in certain cases, I think, when it comes to particularly baseball. They managed to have some of these stats and some of those, you know, the esoterica, John, at their fingertips, which amazes me. Our stuff is a little bit different. Like when there's jockey or horse or trainers that do something unusual, like saddle, whatever, five winners at three venues. I mean, we don't seem to have the database when it comes, at our fingertips. Essentially,
that's right.
Where I assume that they do, they do like a query, they must put in, the various elements, and then it spits it back at them. I don't even know if it'd be possible to. I mean, we haven't even digitized. We haven't even digitized a certain segment of the game's history.
That's right. And here's a case I've written about this in my column or blog many times. And the reason I'm aware of this is because when I was a chart caller, we had to be on top of if a horse tied or broke a track record, tied or broke an American record, or tied or broke a world record.
Huh.
And the main source for that was the American Racing Manual, and which you have many editions of, as do I. But the thing is that Equibase does not have a list of world records. And I've talked to them about that, and they said, well, we don't know if a horse has run faster somewhere else, in England or whatever. And so that's, they don't. So if a horse today, when Dr. Fager set a world record, we knew it because we had the list, and you go by the list, and he broke the record, and so we could put new world record. And the difference that a lot of people don't understand, and I had to explain this to a lot of publicity people through the years, in terms of educating them as to what was an American record and what was a world record. An American record is the fastest time on either dirt or turf. So you let's say you ran the fastest mile on dirt, but it wasn't the fastest mile, there was a faster one on turf. So the world record was the fastest time on any surface under any conditions. That's why when Secretariat won the Belmont Stakes, he was not credited with a world record. It wasn't a world record because the world record was held at a mile and a half on the turf at Santa Anita, even though part of that was downhill. But the way world records were recognized at that time by the Daily Racing Form was that you needed to have the fastest time under any conditions, whereas the American records were broken down to the fastest time for a mile on dirt and the fastest time for a mile on turf.
Huh. Which, of course, I mean, as we've come to understand regarding speed figures, the records are somewhat immaterial. I mean, they're interesting, but it's a mile on. Is it a mile on a sandy beach or a mile on paved road? That enters into it in the modern era in terms of what would be the variant and what does it represent considering how hard the surface is.
That's right. Well, I remember that we had one at Santa Anita on a sealed track that a horse set a track record, and I even put it in the footnote that this was a track record influenced by the condition of the track. So you make a great point there, Steve, no doubt about it.
John White, everybody, and John, you'll have your Belmont thoughts Wednesday.
Yes, I will. And boy, this is a confusing Belmont for me. I'm really having a tough time with it. I can tell you that it's a really interesting betting race. This is a very interesting Belmont coming up.
John White, everybody. Post time, John. We're going to wrap up the morning. We got about 6 or 7 minutes, and Mike Welch is going to spend it with us. One thing I did not mention, because we launched right into the Churchill situation this morning, as literally as we were going on the air, and I knew it was going to happen because I saw Jimmy Barnes and I saw Tanya and John Terranova. National Treasure was going to have his final work, and Red Route 1 was out as well. So Mike's going to join us. And hey, there he is, Mike Welch. Good morning.
Good morning.
A little bit of noteworthy activity Monday before Belmont.
Yeah, a little bit surprising, I guess. You're only 6 days, 5 days out from the race. I mean, you knew what you were going to get from Steve Astrieson with Red Route 1, but wasn't quite sure what to expect with National Treasure today. I mean, you know, you're talking about two Hall of Fame trainers with completely opposite kind of training styles, especially when you get this close to a race. So I guess it wasn't that surprising that Bob had National Treasure do a whole lot more today, especially after last week's work didn't quite go as originally planned.
Well, and talk about it, because this, this coming out of Preakness, yeah, this is a serious work.
Yeah, no, it was. And, you have to, be cognizant of the fact that was a pretty grueling race he had in the Preakness. And you got to be worried that, to come back in 3 weeks and then to try to go a mile and a half is asking this horse a lot. Again, I wasn't sure, what to make of that last work. But he looked terrific today. I mean, Dave Grenning and I were in agreement, nodding in approval afterwards. He went quick, and he continued to show good energy all the way and did it easily. I mean, I had him a half in 47, then just under two. I had 59 and two for 5/8, and that's, down the home straight. There's still kind of a long run through the wire. It's still another straight eighth of a mile to complete the 5/8. But, then he went the strong end of the turn. He went six furlongs at 11 and three and pulled up 7/8 and 125 and three. So, it seems a lot to ask just 5 days out, but that's kind of Bob's style. And the thumbs up as far as he looked today. I mean, still the question is, can he, reproduce or move forward off that last effort and get the mile and a half? But the mile and a half's the question you got to ask for most of them, if not all of them. So he's probably in no different a boat there or a situation there.
Mike Welch joining us, and it was a busy weekend, or not busy, because we don't have 20 Derby horses. We've got about 10 Belmont horses. But let's talk about the Pletcher horses for a second, Mike, because obviously Tappet Trice and Forte, for different reasons, getting plenty of attention, and they were noteworthy works. And I do want you to also mention Dorth Vader from the other morning, from I think Friday morning. Alert everybody to her important effort.
Yeah, I mean, I like what I saw from her here. I mean, I've seen her work all winter long. We've talked about her works. She can go 5/8, without blinking an eye in 59, and I've even seen her go quicker than that. But she's with George Weaver now. Actually, in her last work with Michael Yates down in Florida before she shipped, she worked on the synthetic track, and they were able to slow her down that day too, just kind of got her around there. The work was supposed to be on the main track, but the track came up muddy, so they put her on the synthetic. But they got her to relax and rate the other day and finish up well, gallop out nicely. I think she's coming into this race well. I thought her race, in the Oaks was sneaky good. She hesitated a little bit getting out of the gate, and because of that got hung 3-4 wide and maybe one spot further back, prompting the pace than you would have liked to see her. And she held in pretty well. She only got beat a few lengths, and I thought it was a big effort. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of strategy they use here in the Oaks. But I'm going to guess they're going to try to rate her off and make one run with her for her new trainer.
How about the Pletcher pair? Talk about Forte and Tappet Trice from Saturday.
Well, like the two works we saw today, completely opposite in design. Tappet Trice obviously, has had a race under his belt. It was 5 weeks ago, obviously in the Derby, but that's not a bad spacing coming into the Belmont, where Forte you know, as we all know, missed the Derby and now is going to be 10 weeks idle coming into the Belmont, which is kind of a bit of a daunting situation. So they asked him to do a little bit more, and he responded. He had Irad Ortiz up. It was his second, you know, pretty good work here, pretty strong work here. He galloped out well. He was in company with a maiden winner, an A other than allowance horse, who did hold his own with him all the way around. I mean, so, you know, while on the watch, the work was excellent. Visually, it was excellent. You might question the fact that a horse of lesser credentials was able to stay with him all the way, but it appears he's doing really well. And I you know, obviously the foot issue is nothing to be concerned about. You know, I think it's more a question of, do you think he'll go the mile and a half, and do you think he's going to feel the effects of not having run in 10 weeks? That's the biggest question there as far as Forte goes. Tapitrice, just a maintenance move the other day, but he just looks spectacular. I mean, he dominated the work with a workmate all the way around. You know, one by, it was two in front at the wire, could have been more. It was five in front galloping out, and he just sustained that good momentum. He has that gorgeous stride. I'm just, you know, a little bit, it was so disappointing the way he ran in the Derby. I know he dropped back to last, and at that point it was a pretty tough task for him to, you know, to pass 19 horses, or 17 or 18, whatever it was in the field. But, you know, I thought he would run better than that. He didn't seem to really have that a solid kick at any point. But, you know, the mile and a half is what really everyone has been saying is going to be his game. I mean, there are a lot of people anointing him the Belmont winner back in February, and there's still a lot of people on that bandwagon. And I'm sort of on it, too. I mean, I really like what I've seen from him since I've been here.
Well, we'll obviously have plenty more to talk about. How are you handling the reports Thursday, Friday, Saturday?
Yeah, we'll have workout reports Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I believe we're going to have one Sunday too. And then we're trying to decide whether to move forward from here, just go through the rest of the meet. That's still to be decided. But we'll have regular reports. You know, I've been here for, I'll have 2 weeks of work, and Mike Vesey was here for a few days. We'd love to have a little more lead in, maybe one more weekend of works, but we just couldn't get anybody here the Preakness weekend, unfortunately. But we've seen a lot of these horses at least once, and some of them twice that'll be running over the weekend. So I think the report, the same as Derby. You know, we get about 2 weeks run up, but the Derby reports were pretty insightful this
Absolutely.
Year. So. Hopefully things will work out well for Belmont Day and Belmont Weekend as well. So that's the plan right now.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Mike. Are we where's Dave? Are we having a pizza toast to Privman?
Yeah, I mean, well, we've already got a reservation in for post Belmont for Saturday night, and as far as the lead up, that's to be determined.
All right,
so.
I'm sure I will see you. Maybe shortly. Mike Welch, everybody. DRF Welch, the Clocker Report, DRF. And we'll talk to both Dave and Mike, obviously, at least once or twice more before we send you out into Belmont weekend. Let's send you out into the Monday. I got Dick Powell's Presque Isle grade is up at the website. Lots of other action on this Monday. Back with you here at Belmont Park tomorrow. We'll start to ease into the action. I want to thank Mark Cassie, Kenny McPeak, Dale Romans for their dealing with the Churchill Ellis situation. Rich Migliori, John White, and Mike Welch. Talk to you tomorrow, everybody. Good luck today. Riding down the line, we think there is a soul.